bill.
House Bill 222, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to private roads, establishment thereof. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Mercer, Vice Chair.
Thank you. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 222 do pass, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to our favorite attorney out of House District 14.
Look at him go. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, which everyone should have in front of you. I'll explain the amendment, and then I'll explain the bill, I think, before we vote on the amendment. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 addresses a problem that has arisen in private road actions since we redid the statutes. When we redid the statutes, we said, and thank you to the representative from Sheridan County the other day, I went back and reread the case. There's a Wyoming Supreme Court case called Dunning, and in that case, the Supreme Court took note of the fact that a private road could only be located by the viewers and appraisers over property that was identified and notice given by the petitioner. And that, the Dunning case highlighted that and made us all think, well, maybe there ought to be some opportunity for the individuals whose land is at jeopardy for the private road to say, well, there's another route. There's some more people that ought to be in this. So we fixed that in the statute, but we never put a time limit in it. What this does, this amendment is simple. It says, petitioner petitions, he makes known the parties that are affected by the route that he proposes. Then this amendment says those parties who are affected, those are called the affected parties, have 20 days after they're given notice of this petition to come back into the petition, into the commissioners and say, well, there's other property. There's other possible routes. It goes on other possible property, and those landowners are not parties to the action, and then this provides a procedure to make them parties to the action. The problem before was there's a 60-day notice period in here, and the petitioner would petition for a road. Nobody would say anything until the commissioners meet, 60 days notice, you're 90 or 120 days into this thing. Then the affected parties come in and say, well, now wait, we got to start over because there's some other possible routes and some other possible people. So this just puts a time frame on it. And then if that happened, then with that 60-day notice and a couple commissioners' meetings, you could be 240 days into this thing before you ever get to a hearing. And so what this does is puts a 20-day period on it. The parties over whom the road is being proposed are going to have 20 days, which is the standard response time for a lawsuit, at least that's served in the state of Wyoming. They're going to have 20 days to decide, well, there's some other places the road should go. There's some other neighbors here whose property would be affected. Go on to the commissioners and say, look, these other people ought to be parties so that when that 60-day notice finally goes to all parties that could be affected. That's the amendment. Then the bill is an attempt to help with what we passed last time. Last time we added a provision in the statutes in private roads, and we said, after the commissioners have the first hearing and determine that the petition's correct and that there's no legally enforceable access, unless the petitioners elect to retain jurisdiction, at that point the matter moves from the commissioners to the district judge. And again, that had a lot of things to do with these notice periods and commissioners only meeting every 30 days and a lot of confusion over the procedure and lots of attorneys and county commissioners getting sidetracked into a quasi-judicial capacity instead of running the county. And finally, last time, it had been proposed a number of times, finally last time the County Commissioners Association came in and said they didn't oppose it anymore. They thought it was a good idea. I think because all of our counties commissioners have had an excessive amount of time tied up in these things, and they'd rather let the judge handle them. So we made that big step last time, but we sort of left it up in the air exactly how it works. And there is a procedural quirk in here, because when the commissioners proceed up to the point where they determine the petition's proper and the property's landlocked and a private road ought to be put in, that's a proceeding under the Administrative Procedures Act. At that point, it goes to the district court, and the district judge is going to look at what the commissioners have done and review that, and that's really an appeal under the Administrative Procedures Act. And then if the district judge is satisfied the commissioners have done everything properly to that point, he's going to proceed forward, but he's going to proceed forward under the rules of civil procedure. And it's convoluted procedurally. So this fixes it and tells the district judge, unless the if the commissioners elect to retain it, then the whole thing moves under the Administrative Procedures Act. If the commissioners don't elect to retain jurisdiction, then it defaults to the district court. When it defaults to the district court, then that initial determination by the county commissioners that the petition's proper and that the property's landlocked and it ought to have a private road is a final decision. And the district court reviews that in the context of a contested case under the Administrative Procedures Act and rules either that the commissioners have acted properly and he's going to go on or can kick it back. But when he makes that ruling, that's a final decision under the Administrative Procedures Act and brings an end procedurally to that part of the case. And then if there's an appeal, which on some rare occasion there might be, there's going to be an appeal that goes up to the Supreme Court right there as an appeal of a contested case under the Administrative Procedures Act and come back down before the judge proceeds on with the rest of the case. That takes some time. I can just tell you in my experience with these, it's going to be less time than it's been in the past. In the last major case like this I had, I was in the Supreme Court, and they kept saying, why did this thing take 4 years? It's supposed to be an expedited procedure. And I really couldn't explain it because it wasn't in the record. But trust me, it took 4 years for a reason. So that is what this does, is it concludes the first part, hands it off to the district judge in an orderly manner, concludes the proceeding under the Administrative Procedures Act, gets that over with. Then the judge goes on from there under the rules of civil procedure, appoints the viewers and appraisers, has the hearings, listens to the experts, the appraisers, and all that, makes a final determination on the location of the road and the amount of damages that are payable and any conditions that might go on the road. So that's an explanation of both the amendment and the bill. Mr. Chairman, and I'd stand for questions. If there are no questions, I'd call for the question first on the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Question has been called. Mr. Speaker, please proceed.
Excuse me.
Keep that. Don't give it back to me.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my only question is, we've gone from the process now with the commissioners. Why do we even have the commissioners involved at all now in determining necessity? Why don't we just go right to district court with the whole process?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, I think that's where we're evolving, and it's just been a long evolutionary process. And some of you that have worked in private roads a lot recall an old case called McGuire versus McGuire. And in that case, there was a dissent, and the dissenting justice said these things ought to be entirely in the district court right now, and he used a set of statutes and some of the rules to show that everything was in place to put these with the district courts right now. And the next year, the legislature repealed one of the rungs in his ladder. So there's been a lot of resistance, and the commissioners didn't want it. And as an interim procedure, it's just been the judgment that the commissioners would like to be involved initially. Maybe they know the ground better anyway in terms of, is this a legitimate action? Is the land really landlocked? Should it really have a private road? And so we just left that part there. Someday I think it probably will evolve totally to a proceeding in the district court. But there's just a lot of history there and a lot of resistance to even getting as far as we are now.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, please go ahead.
So on the amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, if you don't file this notice of an alternative route within 20 days, how does that affect your rights?
That would be the, Mr. Chairman, that would be the cutoff for the opportunity to have other landowners joined into the proceeding, other landowners whose property might contain alternate routes that besides those proposed by the petitioner.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up to that. Is there anything in here that says that the notice has to tell you about this timeline, and that if you don't do this, you lose the ability to nominate an alternate route?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, it does not. One's going to have to rely on the statute for that. You can see, beginning on line 10 on page 1 of the amendment, the existing language that says within 10 days after the application's filed, the applicant gives notice to all affected parties. Those affected parties then have 20 days, which would be the typical time that you would respond in a civil action. That 20 days is the time that they have to give notice to the board and the applicant of the location and description of any alternate routes proposed by the affected parties.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under subparagraph E in amendment, in the amendment, I wonder if this slows it down even further. Maybe it doesn't. You still have the 60-day requirement. 60 days before the hearing is when the notice goes out of the hearing date. And this just says, as I read it, that the petitioner has to notice everybody he noticed originally in, under subparagraph B, but then has to notice everybody else who's on the alternative route. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And that, I believe, is going to be faster than the situation that many petitioners have run into, where they give the 60 days notice and actually go to the hearing. So they're 90 or maybe 120 days into it, and then those parties are showing up and saying, well, wait, there's other routes that the commissioners ought to take into consideration. And then if the commissioners join them at that point, then it's another 60-day notice, which coupled with 30-day frequency of meeting of the commissioners might push it out. And that's why I say you might be 240 days out before you ever finally get to your hearing.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, if I were opposed to the road and I was a landowner, under the language here, I could nominate 15 proposed alternative routes that might go any number of ways. And if it was a long road, if it was a 3-mile road, it might cross 20 additional landowners. And then I have to notify everybody who you tell me or whoever notifies the commissioners that the road could pass over as an alternative route. There's certainly some opportunity for mischief there. Did you have any discussions about that?
Mr. Chairman,
please, Representative.
We did not have discussion on the Committee of the Whole Amendment. I guess we're having that discussion right now. But there is room for mischief in there, but there's always been room for mischief in this thing. And what we've tried to do is cut some of the mischief down. I believe this makes it less mischievous than it's been in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, Representative Brown, do you have anything else?
No, I'd call for the question on the Committee of the Whole Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Question. Question having been called on the Committee of the Whole Amendment for House Bill 222, number 1. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment, number 1 for House Bill 22, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The ayes have it. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question. Question on the bill. Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Mercer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so, the recommendation that Bill number 222 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The ayes have it. House Bill 222 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 229. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 229, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to court security reimbursement. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, no, Throne, sign representing Gingrey, Chairman.
Thank you. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 229 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment number 1, and I turn over the explanation. Well, I guess we can do the Standing Committee Amendment real quick. All this did, the Standing Committee Amendment, the sponsor had in there throughout it that the Court Security Commission was doing everything, and the committee had a long discussion about it. It actually should have been the Supreme Court doing it. And so primarily what we were doing was switching around who would be in charge of this fund. Unless there's any questions, I'd ask for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question having been called. All those in favor of House Bill 229, Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye. All those opposed, say no. I believe the ayes have it. Chairman Gingrey.
Now I would turn over the explanation to the good gentleman from Laramie.
Representative Brown, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am a member of the Wyoming Court Security Commission, which is a body that we recently created. That commission has considered a number of court security matters, and at the suggestion of one of the senators considered the idea of a contingency fund for security at high-profile cases. We do now have a contingency fund for prosecution of these high-profile cases, and I don't think there's some pretty interesting cases in our past that I don't think it'd be correct to mention the names on the floor, but if anybody'd like to hear about them, I'm happy to tell you which ones they are. But we've had a number of them in the past. About 10 years ago, we had one right across the street from my office that was quite involved. We had one in Thermopolis. Some of these high-profile cases have an additional complication in that there's frequently a change of venue. And that occurs where a court, wherever the charge is brought or the case originates, feels that the community is so prejudiced or there's so much emotion involved that it'd be impossible to have a fair trial, and so there's a change of venue and the judge sends that case somewhere else. And when we have these high profile cases, typically they require a lot of extra security, and it's especially unfair if there is a change of venue and one of these cases is sent somewhere else and some poor unsuspecting county is just sitting there minding its own business and all of a sudden it has this case and it's responsible for the security involved. And I have I don't want to mention any names, but I have an email from the Supreme Court about two cases. The one across from my office 10 years ago, security cost was $124,000. There was also another case here not very long ago that was on a change of venue where the cost was $120,000. So the question is, what should we do about this? And it was the feeling of the Court Security Commission that we ought to set up a contingency fund. There is already a contingency fund that's administered by the Attorney General for the extra costs of prosecution in these cases, but that fund is only for the cost of prosecution and not security. And that fund probably could not be used for security anyway, because that is in the executive branch administered by the Attorney General. And this fund that we have for security needs to be administered by the Supreme Court and the judicial branch, because it has to do with how we operate courtrooms. So this would set up a contingency fund with $100,000 in it. Another thing the amendment did is took out the reverter. It originally had a provision in it that anything that wasn't expended in that would revert. This amendment takes it out and says it lays there. It requires the Supreme Court to develop criteria, and the fund will lay there until it's needed and then it can be expended for courtroom security. And it seems like a good notion, especially in view of some of our other thoughts we've had about continuing maintenance expenses, trust funds, and that sort of thing, to set up a contingency fund, put this money there, and it won't be expended until it's needed. And when it is needed, there will be a source to pay for that. So that's the explanation, Mr. Chairman. And if there are no questions, I'd call for a question on the bill.
Representative Brown, was there another motion on the Committee of the Whole amendment for this bill? Did we already pass that?
We had the, I thought we had the standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, and that was passed.
So that's it? Okay. I apologize.
Was there a Committee of the Whole amendment? Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. There is a Committee of the Whole amendment. What that...
Would you like to make a motion?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. I'm mixed up between the Committee of the Whole Amendment and the Standing Committee Amendment. The Committee of the Whole Amendment is the one that it rewrites this and just directs, it makes the bill really short. And you can see that the substance of the bill is contained in Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, lines 18 through 28. It just tells the Supreme Court to establish criteria. And before distributing the funds to a county, the Supreme Court should enter into an MOU that provides for the use of those funds. And then this, in fact, is the amendment that takes out the reverter clause. So I'd call for the question on the Committee of the Whole amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Question. You've heard the question on the Committee of the Whole. All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole amendment on House Bill 229, number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment has been adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question? Question on the bill? Question have been called. All those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 229 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. The ayes have it. House Bill 229 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Zwanitzer, you have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the body, I would like to introduce you to some old friends and hopefully some new friends. Behind me in the West Gallery, you'll see several familiar faces when they were interns here, and hopefully some future faces of the legislature when they run for office. Right now, they're members of the ASUW group in Laramie, and they're here today to talk to us about issues that are affecting the university. If they would please stand up, and you welcome them to the chamber.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Oh, he's good.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, there's somebody in the balcony, a young lady that I'd like to introduce, and she's from my class of 1966 at Shoshone High School, and she's now, she's the most successful one of them all. She's now the manager of Wyoming Public PBS and or public television. And Ruby Calvert, would you welcome her? To the
thank you for being here. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I passed out some points that, around to you that would help explain some of the issues that you were having with the Community College Amendment Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Did I see somebody else, or did that individual sit down? The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 242. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 242, introduced by Representative Buchanan, an act relating to motor vehicles. This bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Zwanitzer, Dave. No, Gilmore, Peterson, signed representing Cohey, chairman.
Thank you. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Cohey.
Good
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. I almost needed an off-road vehicle to get through the roadblock. Members of the House, I move that when Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 242 do pass. For a complete and full explanation of the bill, I defer to the Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring before you House Bill 242 and ask for your favorable consideration. Basically, this bill modifies the definition of off-road recreational vehicle there, if you see on page 2, and increases some of the parameters, one from the width 50 inches to 60 inches, and the weight from 900 pounds to 1,500 pounds, and it also includes those vehicles that are equipped with a bench or bucket seat. And basically the reason for this is over the last several years, ATV manufacturers have been both manufacturing original or stock all-terrain vehicles that exceed the 50-inch dimension. Also, a lot of aftermarket products are now sold that cause these vehicles to weigh more than 900 pounds or to exceed the 50-inch width limit. And a lot of these vehicles are designed more now for couples to ride in and families and so forth and so on. And as most of you know, to be able to get the ORV permit, to be able to travel on public lands and other designated roads, trails, and acreages, both in BLM land and on state lands, you have to have that sticker. And without the change in this definition, that makes that impossible unless you wanted to license one of these vehicles. So that's the bill. There are no standing committee amendments, and I call for the question if there are no questions.
Question? Question having been called. All those in favor of Representative Cohee's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 242 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
The ayes have it. House Bill 242 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 100. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 100, introduced by the Select Water Committee, an act relating to water development projects. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which respectfully reports back that it should pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman Semlek, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 100 do pass. And Mr. Chairman, I turn the discussion of the bill over to the co-chair of the Select Water Committee from House District 10, and he will give you a watered-down version of the bill.
Representative Anderson, please steer us through this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your desk is what we'd call a cheat sheet of what is contained in the bill. If that will help you, I want, just for a little background, these projects are all reviewed over and over by the Water Development Commission and the Select Water, almost to ad nauseam. Sometimes we hear them over and over. There are not enough funds for all the requests, so they are sorted out on a priority basis. It seemed to be most important. If you want to know about any one of those projects in this planning bill, it's in the blue book that you've seen somewhere in your pile of books. If you want to know about all the water projects, the construction bill as well, that'll be coming over from the Senate. They're all in here in alphabetic order. The criteria for them and all the rest. I would like to explain just a little bit about the bill. If you would look on page 2 and on other pages where you see each one of those projects listed, the ones that are underlined were approved last year. This is kind of an annual bill on a biannual budget. The ones that are not underlined are new appropriations from the Water Development Account 1, 2, or 3. Most of these are in account 1 or 2 because they're in the planning stage. With that, if there are no questions, I again want to say that these probably projects have been reviewed over and over and very thoroughly discussed. The engineers work on them. The names of those people that have worked on it are in the front of your books. Water Development Commission composes of 10 people throughout the state, and Select Water is 6 members from each house that finally approve these ominous water bills. And we'd be glad to try to answer any intelligent questions.
Representative Stepson with an intelligent question.
No, I do not. But I would like to declare conflict on the bill.
Representative Teeters has the intelligent question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to correct the good chairman, but the underlined language is the new projects.
Thank you. You follow the script well again.
Representative Anderson, are we okay?
I think we're all right. I'm just a little getting tired of getting corrected by certain individuals.
I'll let you guys work that out at Christmas time. Question having been called, all those in favor of Representative Semlick's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 100 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. House Bill 100 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 234. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 234, introduced by Representative Patton, an act relating to taxation and revenue, tax assessed property values. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, No, Escobel, Semlek, and Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. The bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended a do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, and Hammonds. I'm sorry, Stewart, No, Hammonds, and Jorgensen. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Anderson. Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 234 do pass. We do have a standing committee amendment, and I would like to move that. In fact, we have 2 standing committee amendments, but I'll move standing committee amendment number 1 to House 234, and what it does is change the language on page 2 from a yearly assessment by our county assessors. They said they don't always get to those properties in that length of time. And so what it says, just use the most recent on-site inspection. Kind of gives them an out with the way they're staffed. And if there's no questions on that, I would ask for the question.
You've heard the question. Representative Patton? Calling for the question on House Bill 234, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The ayes quietly have it. Back to Representative Anderson. Representative Berger, I apologize. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 234 and just... I think we'll probably ask for the question on it after the good sponsor presents the bill, because that may impact how one would like to vote on this standing committee amendment. But.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I think that's how I'd like to do it, Mr. Chairman. What it does is it appropriates $23,840,000 that would be appropriated to the state treasurer's office because of the impact that this bill would have. And then the second component of it is to appropriate $100,000 to develop the system that he is going to explain through the CAMA system to manage this bill. So with that, I just move it, and I think I will wait for the question on the standing committee minute so that everyone understands the bill.
Representative, thank you. Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, and that'd be fine. I think we could do it either way, but I'd want to refer to Representative Patton for the explanation of the bill.
Representative Patton, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thanks to both the Chairman Speak and Sheridan, Chairman from Appropriations. I say that particularly because of the way that this measure was handled by the two committees and the positive response and constructive thoughts that they gave the measure. Before I get into the body of the bill, I would just like to comment that this bill does not change the tax assessment process. It's not intended to get into an argument as to how the assessed value is arrived at, but rather to look at the volatility of the current assessment process, where we have a 20%, in some cases higher than a 20% increase in a given year, due to factors outside of the control of either the business owner, the small business owner, or the homeowner. So my view of this is that it's not that the people of the state of Wyoming are not the lowest taxpaying burden people in the United States. If they're not the lowest, they're the second lowest, according to a recent editorial that we saw in a local paper. It is, however, a fact that our people, by virtue of the increases that have occurred over the last 5 years, have found that the volatility is objectionable. They can't plan. People that are on fixed income, people that have young businesses, find themselves unable to plan for what their tax burden may be in the coming year. And so it is this volatility, and that is what 234 addresses. Please note on the pages in number 2, we wanted to make the language explicit, and you'll see that what we're talking about is the assessed valuation. So the assessed valuation is that part of the tax assessment that we wish to address. And the amendment that you have already adopted does clear the phrase error in the bill, and I believe that you have adopted that. If that is correct, Mr. Chairman.
That is correct. It has passed.
There are two sides to most tax issues, the taxpayer and then the revenue beneficiary. In this particular case, everybody is acquainted with the taxpayer. They're your constituents. And on the other side, however, is education, county government, and city government. And that is why the measure was prepared with the idea of having a backfill so that county government, city government, and the education foundation program would not be penalized, or this measure would not be put on their backs. I do understand, and I'm sensitive to the debate and discussion about that, but I'll leave that to others to address. What we're doing is we're actually saying that there should be a 3-year average, and the approach to this is in Article 11 and Article 12 of our state constitution. Article 12 has 3 classifications of property, and this addresses only the Roman numeral number 3. So that is all other personal property tax, all other personal property. And that is what the evaluation and the assessment is about. Instead of interrupting the current system, what we're suggesting is that it be averaged, taking the 2 previous years and adding that to the current year, and you end up with an average. I hope that everybody has on their desk this handout, in which there were a demonstration that shows a probable case of $200,000 house or property starting off in 2007 and then taking a 10% increase up through 2011. And you'll note that the first column of figures is 2009. And the average at that time of the assessed valuation, we did not change the assessment rate. So the $242,000 value in 2009 at 9.5% is $22,990. If you take the two previous years and add those together with the current year of 2009, you end up with an average of $20,963. What happens then is that the assessed valuation, the current assessed valuation, according to Article 11, would be then $2,027 higher than the average. Article 12 provides that the legislature is empowered. The last line of the sentence in the article states that the legislature is empowered to have exceptions, and that this exception that we are working with is the key to the bill. The exception then sets aside the amount that is over and above the average. Thus, you have the leveling figure. However, note in 2010 that the $242,000 that is included in the factoring, with the increase taking it to $266,000, and thus progresses the rolling average year after year. With that, the most frequent question that I have had is the question of, well, what happens when it goes down? If the average is higher, then the people are going to pay higher. But think carefully now. What we're talking about is the implementation of the exception in Article 12. Article 12 then provides for the exemption of the calculation that is over and above. So in 2012, you'll note that the actual value with a 10% decrease ends up with an assessed valuation of $25,000, which is less than the average. Thus, the exemption is inoperative. And the assessed valuation then that the taxpayer will pay on would be the $25,036. So as you can see, it goes down as rapidly as it had gone up in the past. But as a matter of fact, if we can look at the future with this kind of an economy that we're in, I'm not saying that it's going to be, but it may be that it's going to go down faster than with this formula than it would had it not been in place. The result is that you end up with a calculation. You can plan. It functions on all personal property. Thus, it ends up being a general policy and not a targeted audience of recipients. Older property will mathematically enjoy a greater benefit than property owned or built in 3 years or less, and the revenue projections on education, counties, and cities should be more stable. Lastly, the backfill mathematically would be reasonable to consider for not more than a two-year period, because after 2 years are over with, then you are dealing with the actual average, and there will be no further request, or there shouldn't be, by virtue of this, be any request for any general fund appropriation for a backfill to the counties, the cities, and the school districts. And with that quick overview, I'd be willing to yield the floor to anybody else who wanted to speak in favor of the bill.
Representative Patton, I don't know if you'll get that, but are there any questions for
him? I'll yield the floor to my friend and co-sponsor.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the body, you would not believe the elegant picture of a graph that I have on my computer that I was going to print out and show you what a brilliant idea the sponsor of this bill has brought to us. But on my computer, I think it says right now, could not start print job. Check print setup. So I called the people who are supposed to do that 45 minutes ago, and we're still waiting for it. So I'm going to have to just talk a little bit about, this averaging. The thing about the averaging is that, if we'd had this bill or this law, this statute in on the books 6 years ago, we wouldn't be having these conversations about homestead exemptions and cutting tax rates and all these other things, because this particular process has the ability to take 80% of the pain out of paying taxes. Well, maybe not quite that much, but it takes a lot of the pain out, because it does make it predictable, and it's surprising how little the fiscal impact really is if you simulate it out. This example that I was telling you about, that I see another representative monkeying with right now, for a tax flow of 10 years, that where you pay $18,000 over 10 years, the amount of relief that you get is about $700 or $800, but it's all through making it more predictable and making the rises more less jagged through time. And that's the beauty of the thing, and the thing that would make taxpayers happier. Now, the other question I have deals with something kind of separate, and that's the technical aspect of implementing it. If you look at Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, it says that it changes it from 2009 to 2010. And then I think in the Appropriations Committee's appropriation, they're appropriating it for the tax year assessed for 2009. I don't think we need that appropriation for this year, because it wouldn't go into effect until 2010, unless I'm mistaken. At least that's the way I'm hoping it is, because I think that the appropriate time for this particular bill we're talking about right now to go on the books and be effective would be in 2010, where we got it more leveled out. So.
I see our tech support chairman here coming.
Okay, that's all I have right now, and maybe we'll have more to say after my computer expert actually got a copy of this coming around now. So, thank you,
Chairman Childers. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the only question I have no problem with doing this for residential properties, but since commercial is also involved in that, did you determine the impact on commercial properties? Because, you know, they pay a little different taxes than the residents do. They don't pay sales taxes. And I'm not disagreeing that the residents need a reduction in property taxes, but do we need to do it for commercial? If you could answer that question, please.
Representative, Chairman Cohey, and then Chairman Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm unprepared to answer the question. Perhaps a representative from Sheridan County can, but that I do know it addresses only those issues in Section 15 in the Constitution, 3, Romanet 3, which is all properties taxed at the rate of 9.5%. I do know that it touches that. So as far as I know, the request for the appropriation includes all those commercial properties, not industrial. Industrial being taxed at the rate of 11%, that this includes certain commercial properties of a small nature, which could be of some benefit to Wyoming small business operators. But, ladies and gentlemen, and again, as I can repeat some of the conversation from the good representative from Johnson County, the ingenuity of this concept is so simple that it's smart. It addresses the concerns of the people of my district that are not so much shocked about the property tax, because I've shown them, the ones that have some complaints about the property tax in the state of Wyoming. And we had a handout come around this morning from a tax authority association here in Wyoming that shows Wyoming to rank very, very low in property taxes. It goes on to discuss in that pamphlet that you all received that the public really becomes alarmed with property tax because they get a bill every year and they can compare it to the one before, where in the case of sales tax and they go out and buy items from day to day at their grocery store or at their local hardware store or something, and they simply are applied a anywhere from a 4%, 5%, or 6% tax to it, and they don't think an awful lot about it. And similar to income taxes, of course, we don't have that on a corporate or a personal level, thank goodness, here in the state of Wyoming. But as with respect to your federal income tax, you get a paycheck, your money's already gone, you really don't even think about it. The early creation of income tax, people went and paid it on their own, and the government discovered that people weren't paying it, so imagine that. And a little old bookkeeper in a major department store in New York figured out a way to come up with automatic deductions and withholding at the point of pay. But regardless, people become alarmed at property tax because that's a comparative figure that they can look at one year to the next. And the people in my district are more alarmed about what it cost them last year as what it cost them this year. This concept provides a smoothing process or an averaging of 3 years. You take, 2 years ago and last year, and then this coming year, blend them all together, and so the dramatic increases are not nearly as evident. Not that we're hoodwinking our property owners in the state of Wyoming. They all know their property values have gone up, at least to date. Fortunately for us, and with the appropriation in the bill, it might be possible. Certainly, no guarantees, but the figure that you see there, almost $24 million, if we consider that there's always a little silver lining in every gray cloud, that this might be it. Wyoming is headed into a period of property deflation in many counties, so we're going to see some assessed valuations, particularly with respect to the 9.5% tax properties, suffer probably some deflationary factors. I know that the home I live in probably is worth less this year than it was last year, except for I just bought it 6 months ago. But the realism of it is that the factor in there assumes that all properties will increase by 5%. That is, that are assessed at 9.5%, that they will increase over 5% over the next year or the life of this bill, and that would cost the state of Wyoming to backfill about $24 million. The realism of it is, even though some areas in the state of Wyoming, Sublette County, for example, possibly Campbell County, maybe Sweetwater County, that they're going to increase in value, and certainly the money is there to backfill them. But the timing is perfect because of the economic forces going on in America right now, that in many counties, you'll see some form of stagnation in property values, and frankly, there won't be a need for a backfill. So it's quite potential that much of that $23,900,000 and something, and we love reversions, and we're going to be needing them here in a year or two, so potentially a lot of that could be returned. So I am on and in favor of House Bill 234. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Patton, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Park County's question, the three categories under Title 11 are agriculture, industrial, and then all other personal property. This applies only to the third item, all other personal property. Not industrial.
I see Mr. Childers. Okay, he stepped it down. Representative Harvey, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to thank the good representative from House District 40 for the graph, and I think it's an excellent history lesson, but what I'd like is a crystal ball lesson. If property values are going down as predicted, then how will this smoothing affect that? And what I'd really like to know is, where is this going to take us in the future? If we're rounding up and headed back down, then what does that graph look like?
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when I heard the word crystal ball, did you guys all see the Super Bowl commercials? Got the crystal ball. It just made me crack up. Anyway, wanted to share that with you. Free snacks for the day and then a promotion for his boss, if you saw that one. If you didn't, I don't know. Yeah, get on the internet. But you missed the perfect one. You guys who did know what I'm talking about. Anyway, this amendment does not provide that crystal ball, particularly the second part with his boss. But back to this amendment, what you're on. I would just tell you the $23,840,000. If you think this is a great idea, which I do, I think it's a great idea, and it would have been nice to have this lined up side by side the other day like we had, I think it was a 68 and 87. We kind of had them towed up nose to nose. If the reason why the Appropriations Committee was so insistent that this appropriation go forward, see, because the change date almost You didn't need an appropriation. But it is, I think, good policy from this body. If we believe in something and we want to pass it, let's fund it and pass it. Don't just kick it down the other end of the hall and think they'll fix it or whatever. If you think this is a great idea, vote aye on this standing committee amendment number 2 and then aye on the bill. And, again, appreciate the good bringer of this bill. I think it's a great idea. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have a question? Oh, Representative Landon, Chairman. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It's my impression that this bill offers two primary benefits. Is when I talk to people in my district, after we have a conversation about property taxes, and I ask them, are they putting a lot of pressure on you? Are they really difficult for you to pay? Most people will say to some degree they are, but after hearing, and a lot of people have been educated to know that our tax structure is pretty favorable towards individuals, and most people will acknowledge that their taxes are something that they can handle. What really scares them is the unpredictability of the taxes from one year to the next. And so I think that's one of the great values that's brought in this, is it will have that smoothing mechanism mechanism for them. And I think the second party that benefits are the city and county governments, because I think it also puts some more predictability in their budgeting, they are will also not be so likely to have the swings that we have seen, that they too can predict a little bit more on their income stream as to what it's going to be over the next few years. And then I think one of the best things about this is what it really yields in the long term is it's not cities and counties are kind of harmless, I would say, is the total amount of taxes is going to be collected over time. It just smooths it out over the next few years that it takes for that to happen. So I think this would be a benefit. It looks to me like pretty much a win-win situation, and I would urge your favorable consideration of this bill.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's obvious that we don't have much objection to this bill. Representative Patton started working on me last November, and it took about till almost the 1st of January to totally convince me how valuable this piece of legislation was. So it'll grow on you, I guarantee it. I'd call for the question, and we can get on with another bill.
I just want to remind everybody we're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 for House Bill... Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. We have a question called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 2?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, point of order on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. The point was raised as to whether on line 15 that should read calendar year 2009. Should it be 2009 or calendar year 2010? I think it should be 2010. I would move to make a technical correction amendment to second reading amendment number 2 to House Bill 234 at line 15 to replace 2009 with 2010.
Is there a question on the technical amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment passes. Back to the standing committee amendment number 2. Question? Okay, question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 for House Bill 234 as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment has passed. Are there any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Representative Anders' motion that with the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 234 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. House Bill 234 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 96. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 96, introduced by Representative Buchanan, an act relating to railroads and public highway crossings, railroad quiet zones. This bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Cohey, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phillips, Stewart, signed Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? I believe this is Chairman Cohey's motion. I do not see him on the floor, though. Would the someone else on the bill like to carry the motion? Chairman Cohey, you're up when you get a second. There's not much of a roadblock this time. Maybe it was in the lobby.
My sincere apologies to you, Mr. Chairman, and to the members of the House. I move that when Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 96 do pass. And once again, for a thorough explanation, it will be by... Oh, there is a standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I also move standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 96 at this time to indicate to you, ladies and gentlemen, what the standing committee amendment does. It adds in some language requested certainly by the department and some other cleanup language with respect to things like wayside horns and zones. We did add on page 4, as you can see, that the Joint Transportation Highways and Military Affairs Committee would be receiving a status of equipment installation and with regard to the Quiet Zone program as of October 1st, 2010. And then we did increase the requested amount in the original bill from $500,000 to $2 million, and then we amended the date of implementation to go through 2012. And a few other odds and ends, sundry odds and ends, to make the bill a little bit more palatable. So, Mr. Chairman, I would so move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 96 and stand for questions on the amendment.
You've heard the motion. Any questions on the amendment? Question being called. All in favor of House Bill 96, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For an explanation of the bill, I refer to the bill sponsor, the Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, before the Majority Floor Leader can speak about his Quiet Zone bill, we need to move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 96. It was before appropriations, and what our committee decided to do was to remove this Standing Committee 1's amendment on funding and replace that with funding from the general fund of $500,000. And our reasoning, based on further testimony, was that it was going to take some time for the Highway Department to actually analyze and come up with a project list for the Quiet Zone work that they would be doing. So rather than obligating any of last biennium's funding for this project, we used new funds for that. So basically, this amendment deletes any of the funding components and the reporting from the first amendment. So I'd ask for a favorable aye, and then we'll allow Majority Floor Leader to speak on the bill.
Question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment has passed. Senate Majority Floor Leader. Excuse me, House Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a tad over 40 years old, so I'm not eligible yet. We can all laugh about that over here, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe there's a committee of the whole amendment as well, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But ladies and gentlemen, this is a bill that you have seen before, House Bill 96. And basically what it does is it creates a sub-account under the Highway Protection Crossing account that is administered by the Wyoming Department of Transportation and uses those funds for the commission to establish a priority rating system to establish quiet zones in many of the towns that are most affected by train traffic and the blowing of their horns as they make the grade crossings at all hours of the day and night. The bill basically leaves it up to the responsibility of the commission to establish by rule and regulation a system by which, and I'll get to the committee of the whole amendment, it'll kind of tie in here, but they will establish a system by which they will arrange the assessed valuations of each county in descending order by the counties. And the reason I have that in the bill, this is a change I made last year, was because I thought it was important for the communities to have some skin in the game to make our state dollars go a little bit further. So you can see on page 2 how that's arranged, and it goes anywhere from a 25% match all the way up to a 75% match. Continuing on, it has a reporting requirement on page 4 under subsection F, where they will have to, the Department of Transportation will annually report to the Joint Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs Interim Committee regarding the expenditures of the funds in the subaccount and basically telling them the number of quiet zones that have been installed and the status of the priority list that they are required to develop earlier in the bill. Section 2 is a little bit more interesting, just a little bit of history on that since it went through Transportation and Appropriations. Originally, I had this coming out of the approximately $190 million that we had allocated to the Department of Transportation for fiscal year 09 and 10 in the 08 budget session. But as you may be aware, a lot of those funds have been previously allocated for highway projects, and a lot of bids had been let out. So what I had suggested and what the Transportation Committee did in that first standing committee amendment was, as they said, well, we'll go ahead and we'll take, we'll increase the amount to $2 million and we will take it out of what at the time was profiled as $50 million that would go to the Department of Transportation in this supplemental budget. But of course, as you know, that $50 million was stripped away. So when we went to appropriations the other day, basically, as the good chairman of appropriations told you, they reduced the amount significantly by 75%, which I was certainly grateful, down to $500,000, and then it's going to come out of those reversion funds that are general funds now, reversion funds that had been going to DOT, and then they will have to ask for that in an exception budget request in subsequent years. The Committee of the Whole Amendment, I would move at this time, I'll move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 96. Basically, that's just a little bit of cleanup language on page 3, line 8, where we add in the words and the incorporated municipalities therein, because the way it's worded now on page 3, it sounds like it's all up to the counties. But certainly counties and municipalities can participate in this program, and it's going to be up to them to allocate between themselves how they pay for those matches in getting these railroad quiet zones established. And I'll leave it at that if there are any questions regarding the quiet zones. If you're not familiar with those, I'd be happy to explain that in more detail.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader,
thank you.
I believe we still have the Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 on the floor. I think we need to, or did we pass that? Okay. So you've heard the committee amendment on the floor. Are there any questions? Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 for House Bill 96. All those in favor of Committee Amendment Number one, Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 9 for House Bill 96. Please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. The amendment has been adopted. Is there further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, when I posed the offer to explain what a quiet zone, I had some folks around me tell me that they would like to know what those are. So those of you who don't know, there are several systems that you can put in place, believe it or not, where if you have the right equipment, mainly flashing lights, gates, and the right type of circuitry, you can have two options. You can have a wayside horn, or you can have a crossing that has no noise whatsoever. And the wayside horn is directional sound at a lower frequency so that only pedestrians and cars in the vicinity of the crossing can hear that. Hence, the rest of the population in the city that's, 4, 10, 20 blocks away can't hear the locomotive blow its horn as it goes through the crossing. So basically, it doesn't disturb the inhabitants of the community. That's the wayside horn aspect. The other is if you install certain types of equipment that better impede a car's ability to circumvent the safety devices and drive through the gates and get whacked by a train. Federal law allows it so that trains don't have to blow their whistles at all, so it's totally silent. So those are the two main types of quiet zones. Of course, the silent one is a little bit more expensive than the other.
Please proceed, Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question for the House Majority Leader. I'm very familiar with it. It seems like everything in here. What happened to the bill that we had, either a year or 2 years ago, that was so similar to this that had merit and I thought started the correction of this problem? And maybe it was touched on and I just missed it, but help me understand what happened to the earlier version of this bill.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, you have a response.
Thank you for that good question from the good representative from Natrona County. The bill that we saw last year died in the Senate Transportation Committee. There was an issue regarding the cooperation of the Department of Transportation. And at that time, it wasn't seen so much by that committee as an issue of funding, but rather language and statute that would mandate their cooperation. Because there are issues here about, who's going to take care of it and who's going to maintain it. At the same time, I had, if you'll recall, a budget amendment as kind of a belt and suspenders backup to the bill. And, of course, I told them about that. And so since they knew that I had a budget amendment for the money, they basically killed the bill as proper. Then we went into Appropriations Committee, and we inserted as a footnote language that required the Department of Transportation to cooperate with those communities if those communities had the systems in place that were in compliance with federal law. So the community up in the northernmost county has a quiet zone now because they had the money to pay for it, and that language enabled them to do that because YDOT had to cooperate. The money side of that on the amendment, due to a snafu in the conference committee, was not compromised upon, and I ended up with $0 out of that conference committee.
Chairman Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak to the downside of this bill. My name is on it, and I sponsor it. And as you know, Pine Bluffs lies right on the main line of the Union Pacific. We see about 70 trains a day on that. This is, if we get this bill through and they put that in, it'll stop waking up those young couples in town and our population's level to drop.
I ain't going to touch that one. Question having been called. All those in favor of, let me grab my card. That one threw me. All those in favor of Representative Cohey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 96 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. House Bill 96 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 274. Can I please have the reading clerk read the bill?
House Bill 274, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act relating to alcohol, creating an offense for persons under 21 years of age attempting to gain attendance to liquor dispensing rooms or drive-in liquor areas. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. No, Mercer. Sign, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 274 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I'll dispense with the Standing Committee Amendment. The Committee recognized that I had deleted a section that just didn't need to be deleted by accident. It was subsection A, and subsection A didn't really deal with the bill. I would ask for your aye vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question has been called. All in favor of House Bill 274, Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. It has been amended. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To explain this bill, there is a group that of folks that got a grant from the state earlier this year, and they brought together almost 100 people from around the state, pretty much one or two from every county, from all different disciplines, and they did a comprehensive review of our entire alcohol statutes, running the from underage drinking all the way to DUIs to binge drinking, all the different alcohol issues that involved this state, and they put together a report, and they gave a very detailed report giving actual examples of what we need to do to improve our laws. One of those was dealing with underage drinking. And to point out to you what some of the issues with our underage drinking law is I gave you a handout that says at the top, minors in possession of alcohol. To understand that, on the back side is the current statute. And if you look on the back side, and it's 12.6.101, subsection B, we have this one really long run-on sentence. And within that long run-on sentence is actually two separate crimes, just simply distinguished by the word or. And to understand that, you have to look at what the elements of the crime are. There are two different crimes there. One is minor in possession of alcohol. One is minor under the influence of alcohol, commonly referred to as an MIP or an MUI. The elements of the crime for an MIP, minors in possession, under current law, it's any person under the age of 21 who has any alcoholic or malt beverage in their possession. Real simple elements to that crime. What that means is if you see a person under the age of 21 holding a beer in their hand, that's possession. Minor under the influence, MUI, the elements of that one is any person under the age of 21 who is drunk or under the influence of alcoholic or malt beverages or a controlled substance on any street or highway or in any public place. So here's what the issues are, a few different issues. Number one, the first issue is what's called the Tanner Rule problem. And throughout this state, judges have been throwing out MIP and MUI, both of them, out of their courts, based on the fact that under the current statute, it says who has any alcoholic or malt beverage. And the Tanner Rule is this concept, and it came from a robbery case, but it has applicability here. When you have an or in there, it is the intention of the legislature that we meant one or the other. And that's how courts have interpreted the word or. The problem is that the courts have started saying that the prosecutor and the law enforcement have to prove to the court which was it. Was it malt beverage or was it an alcoholic beverage? Meaning, if you catch someone who's been drinking and they take an alco-sensor, which is a portable breathalyzer, and it shows the presence of alcohol, they have to have proof whether or not it was beer or whether or not it was whiskey, and they have to prove that. Well, in many situations, that's almost an impossibility, and so these cases have been dismissed. There was a famous case in my own county where a senior party was busted and 50 kids essentially all went, were all acquitted, based on the Tanner Rule problem. So we essentially have it on the books, but across the state, we've suddenly have a problem enforcing underage drinking. The difficulty with that is that we have done so much on underage drinking. We've come out with these initiatives, we've geared up law enforcement, we've geared up the courts, we've all said, yes, we want to do something serious about underage drinking, and then once everyone went out a few years ago and started doing it, everyone came back and said, well, we'd love to do it, except the law has so many loopholes in it. So the first thing this does is tries to take out the loophole of the distinction between alcoholic and malt beverage and just use the word alcohol. The second problem that this bill tries to solve is this distinction between an MIP and an MUI. Minor in possession, you can charge anywhere. It doesn't matter if it's a public place, private place. An MUI, it has to be in a public setting. Here's where this becomes problematic. So let's say you have an officer who approaches the door of a private home based on a loud noise complaint. The kid opens the door and perhaps dumbly, invites the officer in to join the party. The officer comes on in, and he suddenly sees 50 children drinking. The only people he can cite in the room are those that are actually holding a beverage, an alcoholic beverage, in their hand. So the kid that's holding a drink can be cited for MIP. He cannot cite the kid that is passed out on the floor for an MUI, because an MUI, minor under the influence, can only be in a public place, never in a private. So what happens is the kid that's smart enough to drop his beer does not get charged. The kid that's dumb enough to keep holding onto his beer gets charged. There's an issue of fairness here as to the charging mechanism. So the next thing this bill does is take out the public place aspect of an MUI. The other thing this bill takes out is the concept of controlled substance. That is covered by other statutes. Doesn't need to be in this bill. The next thing it does, it tries to close this loophole. Right now in the state of Wyoming, and this is always fascinating for people to hear, it's actually legal for a 5-year-old or any kid to drink alcohol. So the law in Wyoming is you can drink as much alcohol as a minor as you want, so long as you do not become drunk or under the influence. That's the distinction. Well, in both states, it's illegal to consume alcohol. But in Wyoming, we actually allow children to drink. They just cannot be drunk or under the influence. So with this bill, it takes out the words drunk. And drunk, again, is an antiquated word that we don't normally see in statutes. It takes out the word drunk or under the influence and puts in consume. I think I covered most of it. Let me see. So those are the main things it does. Also, what the bill does, it goes through and lists the exceptions, and I should mention this real quick. I wasn't trying to really mess with the exceptions. I was just trying to renumber them so that they would fit better into the statute. But when I list the exceptions, people suddenly realize that family exception is not in there. Well, that's another myth of Wyoming. We actually don't have a family exception in the state of Wyoming. What the law actually says is possession, there is a family exception. And let me explain that. The easiest way to explain that is possession, again, is holding alcohol. It's not consuming. So some of the exceptions that are currently in the law for possession, when you're making a delivery of alcohol based on your employment, so if you work for an employer that you need to deliver the alcohol, such as you actually at the age of 18, 19, 20, you actually can work for a liquor store. When the person is serving alcohol based on their employment at a restaurant, again, if you're 18, 19, 20, you can actually serve alcohol. And then the last one, which I always find fascinating, to a person who is actually a licensee. This came about a few years ago. There was a young man who inherited a bar from the death of a parent, but he couldn't hold the license because he was under 21, and this actually, the law was changed to allow a minor to actually hold a liquor license. So those are the three exceptions. What was in the statute was that if you were in the presence of your parents, you could have possession. Well, the concept there, that at least most judges in the state have always interpreted that as, if your dad handed you a six-pack and said, go put that in the car, that's legal. The concept that you could consume alcohol with a parent has never been legal in the state of Wyoming. And just to make that distinction. The other thing that this bill does, It allows for the portable testing device, which is normally called an alco sensor, to be used to show prima facie evidence of a violation if you have a measurable alcohol concentration when you blow into the alco sensor, which is the common evidentiary manner in which that is proven already. And lastly, in subsection K on the last page, you'll see it allows for prima facie evidence that if the evidence brought forward is bottles, cans, or other containers that contain certain words, such as beer, malt beverage, gin, vodka, whiskey, you'll see the list there, that is prima facie evidence that those containers at one time contained alcohol. Here's the difficulty, and here's how some kids have been getting off on these charges. The officers routinely pour out the beer out of the cans and then bring the cans to court for evidence. Then the kids say, you have no evidence that I actually had beer in there. It was actually water, and you've poured out the evidence. This has become problematic because then you have no evidence, and the officers don't want to keep stale beer sitting in their evidence lockup for months before the trial. So that was one way of solving that problem. With that long explanation, I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Swanser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure what this report, speaking against the bill, I'm not sure what the report was this last year, but this is the same bill. It's been dressed up a bit, but it's been an old friend of this body. Actually, it may have been an old enemy to this body, as we've killed it before twice now, and it's back again. And I do understand the intent, and I do understand it's a problem, but we're going from closing loopholes to doing such extreme public policy that it's way beyond what we want to do. I mean, you can read page 2, and it at first glance it sounds very workable, very noble. Anyone under 21 can't purchase or attempt to purchase. They can't solicit anyone to purchase. They can't possess. They can't consume. They can't have any measurable alcohol in their body. Currently, alcohol, you know, includes the mouthwash we use, the hand sanitizer. Under this law, if we pass it like it is, any of the interns or pages who are under 21, if they wanted to sanitize their hands and touch this sanitizer, I can't use a prop, but we all know what they are, it says alcohol on it. I guess they're guilty, or we can charge them with prima facie evidence that it works. What the good chairman failed to mention, and I think where this bill really goes too far, is in the repeal, and it's down on page 6, line 22. What we're repealing a section, we're rewriting it, but we're leaving one very important thing out, and it's the on any street or public highway. What this bill would allow, if we pass it, and I'll just use our good university town, because that's what springs to mind first, because we have a lot of people between 18 and 21 in this town to the west of here, over the hill. If you saw someone under 21 in that house, through the window, whatever, and they had something in their hand that said the word alcohol on it, you could conceivably bust down their door and arrest them with a misdemeanor. And I think that's where the bill continues to go too far, is yes, I understand the intent, but the allowability of what this allows the police to do, I mean, it turns us into a police state. And maybe that's what we need, a pretty big hammer to be stomping out these problems. But I think this bill goes way beyond what we're ready to accept that we think it does, if that made sense. And the scope is just way too broad. So, you know, we talk about antiquated language and the Tanner problem, but there's a system of checks and balances in our law that there is a reasonable proof that the police have to prove in some cases. And I just believe this bill goes too far and would ask the good chairman to explain maybe some of these situations where you do have a product that'll say alcohol, and I know there's got to be another 80 products on the market that we're not putting in statute on page 6 beside brandy, cognac, rum, applejack, whatever that is, ice beer. I don't know what all these things are, but when you start putting these kind of words in the statute, why aren't we putting the other 200 products that have alcohol in them as well? So, once again, I understand the problem. I know it's a very big public policy concern in the state. I also know that our university has a song they play at all the basketball games. And I would ask you that, yes, I think we all know this is going on for those between 18 and 21. And I don't think I'd have a problem if this referenced 18 and younger, because that's really the target audience we're trying to hit here. But we have a large number in our people who are over 18, who are out of their homes, who are not being guarded by their parents, who we have enough freedom. You can own a house at 18, so I guess you can own your own private property, but you can still commit a crime and have the police arrest you in your home for doing this, such as other illegal drugs. It's just way too far, and I don't think this body is ready to accept that we want to go here. So I'd ask you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After the last testimony, I almost feel like you should be under 40 or so before you should even talk about this, because it's so much more closer to the reality that that you live with and that you've recently experienced. But I have a long memory, Mr. Chairman, and I can remember going to school at a couple different places, and the reality is of it is that young people drink alcohol on occasion, and then when young people go home, it looks to me like if they were to celebrate at a wedding or something, and they're 19 or 20, and all of a sudden now they can't have a glass of champagne, and if they do, then they go to another party somewhere, and if they come in and get a breathalyzer, then they're guilty of. And it seemed like to me we always had that parent discretion in here before. So I guess that'll be, I'll just end with that question, although I do worry about how hard we come down on our young people, and it just seems like we get tougher and tougher on them all the time. And so I'll leave with the question is, can a parent allow a child of theirs in their presence at a party or at a meal on a holiday or something, can they allow them to have a glass of wine?
Thank you. We also have a committee of the whole amendment. Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would first ask that we have the answer to the prior question, if we could, and then I'd move that amendment.
Chairman Gingrey.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to the question comes through the amendment. I'd rather deal with the amendment, and let's get this moving.
You heard the man. Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did have this discussion in committee, and some of us were a little concerned about what we believe that was in the law before. The fact that in the discussion we learned that a parent can't have wine with their kids at dinner if they chose to, it caused some of us some concern, and I think most people in Wyoming really believe that that is what the law says. I've actually heard from people in the legal profession who disagree with the interpretation that we've heard here today. And so to clear that up, to make sure that we know that we have these particular liberties as we try to raise our children and do the right things for them, I would move House Bill 274, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. What it would do is it would insert in the exceptions section on page 3, line 14, the language, when a person is in the physical presence of his parent or legal guardian. And that way we provide for that exception very clearly. There is no longer any confusion, and I would ask for the question on the amendment.
Question on the amendment. Representative Zwanitzer.
Thanks. I just have a question. I'm not sure for the representative just spoke or for the good chairman, but where we're putting that, it still goes on line 5 under Romanet 1 that it's for medicinal purposes. So maybe if we could ask what medicinal purposes, if that's the only way you could drink in front of your family members, and if that is going to be a problem or a contradiction in the law.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, it's a separate subparagraph. D, Romanet 1, is the medicinal purposes. This would be D3 as a separate exception. But it was mentioned that Wyoming law does not allow consumption in the presence of your parents. I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with that because of the way the subparagraph B that would be deleted by this bill refers to being drunk or under the influence of alcohol. I mean, there's a reason it says that. There's a reason it says on a public street or highway or whatever it says. I'm sorry, I don't have that with me. But simply because Wyoming, it was said that Wyoming law doesn't address consumption. So how do you get to the point where you say consumption is not allowed when it's not addressed? I don't think you can, but that's aside from the intent of the bill, which is to clarify that is illegal. And I would rise in support of the of Committee of the Whole Amendment number one.
Thank you, Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the interpretation of the law, I think there was an understanding for many years that the section that starts, this subsection shall not apply to possession, and then underneath it says, who is in the physical presence of his parent or legal guardian. That's the law today. The distinction is that the circuit courts, at least, and multiple circuit courts in this state, have ruled that the word possession only applies to actually possessing, not to the word consumption. So even though the law says who is in the physical presence of his parent or legal guardian, that only relates back to the word possession, not to the word consumption. So I'm not going to argue the interpretation. I'm just saying this is what circuit courts have done. I was trying to clarify it so that circuit courts would not continue to rule differently amongst themselves. As to the amendment, the only difficulty with the amendment, and I certainly understand if you want to put the amendment in, the problem is that if you put the amendment in, there's what's called de minimis violations. You're having a drink with your kid, and they have a sip of wine at dinner. That's de minimis. The distinction is that other states have grappled with the family exception. And the problem is, where do you draw the line? I think we all recognize that it's okay to have a beer with your kid or have wine at dinner, but does this, by putting this in here, does this allow for the child to drink as much as they want in the household so long as the parent is present? And then the second problem is, now does that open the door for a parent to order a drink for their child at a restaurant simply because now the person is in their presence? In the past, the restaurants have relied on the rulings that it only applied to possession, not to consumption, because parents have tried that in the past. They've tried to order a beer for their child at a restaurant, and restaurant liquor license holders have recognized that that does not apply. So it's a policy decision. If you want to put the family exception in there, I certainly understand, but I think it'll be problematic to restaurant owners and to and determining the level of how much alcohol can you give your kid. At what point does it become abuse and neglect, and at what point was it just, you know, normal family drinking?
Representative Thurman, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without this exception, the for parents, I mean, I'm of English teetotaling descent, but for those of French, Italian, Swiss, other cultures that I might not be familiar with, Irish, you know, it's part of culture, it's part of family tradition, and that's all we're trying to accomplish here. I think we did carefully, the sponsor of the amendment and I did carefully think through the potential unintended consequences of our proposed amendment and think that they're covered in other areas of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you don't see in the bill is subsection A to 12.6.101. And that says, any person who sells, furnishes, gives, or causes to be sold, furnished, or given away any alcoholic liquor or malt beverages to any person under the age of 21 years who is not his legal ward, medical patient, or member of his own immediate family is guilty of a misdemeanor. That may be, that says that you can't furnish alcohol unless that person is a member of your immediate family. If we make the changes that are in this bill without addressing subparagraph A, you create another conflict because those two sections are then conflicting. And I would think that most judges look at subsection A to determine what the intent of that family exemption, if that's what you want to call it, might be. Was it... In 2004, in the 2005 session, we passed a new statute, 64406, about house parties where minors are present. And that said that no person who owns, rents, leases, subleases, or has any control of any residence or premises shall allow a house party to take place at the residence or premises. If any alcoholic liquor, malt beverage, or drug prohibited by law to be possessed by a minor is possessed or consumed at the residence by any minor, and the person knowingly permitted the residence or premises to be used for that purpose. Now, that addressed the issue of people having parties for kids at their house and not, that aren't their own children. That, I ran that bill, and that bill passed. But it also recognized the immediate family member provision that we see in this bill. I do have some concerns beyond in the bill about that private residence, and I think that can largely be addressed or is largely addressed by that house party bill. Thank you.
Question? Question being called. We're on the committee of the whole amendment number one for House Bill 274. All those in favor of committee of the whole, amendment number 274, committee of the whole, number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Is there any other discussion on the bill? The amendment pass. Excuse me, is there any other discussion? Question? You've heard the question being called. All those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 274 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
I believe the noes have it. Pursuant to House Rule 10-B, the bill having failed a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson.
Aye.
Bagby.
Aye.
Barbudo.
Aye.
Berger.
No.
Blake.
No.
Bonner.
No.
Brechtel.
No.
Brown.
No.
Buchanan.
Aye.
Byrd.
Aye.
Kennedy. Carson.
Aye.
Childers.
No.
Cohey.
No.
Connolly.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Davison.
Aye.
Dirks.
No.
Edmonds.
No.
Esquibel.
No.
Gilmore.
No.
Gingrey.
Aye.
Goggles.
No.
Hales.
No.
Hallinan.
No.
Hammonds.
No.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey. Illaway.
No.
Yagi.
Aye.
Jorgensen.
No.
Landon.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
Aye.
McKim.
Aye.
McComey.
Aye.
Mercer.
No.
Meyer. Meyer.
No.
Miller.
No.
Millen.
No.
Moniz.
No.
Patton.
No.
Peasley.
No.
Patterson. Patterson. Peterson.
Aye.
Philp.
No.
Korberg.
Aye.
Roscoe.
No.
Semlick.
No.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
No.
Thompson.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Throne.
Aye.
Wallace.
No.
Swanitzer Dan.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Byrd, aye to no. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 18 ayes, 42 noes.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 274, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. Chairman Lockhart. I'm sorry. I thought you wanted privilege of the floor. I apologize. Can we please have the reading clerk read the next bill, House Bill 71.
House Bill 71, introduced by Representative Berger, an act relating to film industry incentives. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. No, Brechtel, signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 71 do pass. And I'd further like to request that the good legislator from Sheridan, who happens to be our appropriations chairman, would manage the bill, and she will arrange for screenings after its passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Berger, go ahead.
That's with all those beautiful smiles we have here this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, what we have before you is House Bill 71, which is Film Industry Financial Incentive, which we fondly had nicknamed in 2007 FIFI. And basically what this bill does today is to reduce the amount of incentive required. We have a rebate that would be offered at 12 to 15% based on a production amount spent in the state of Wyoming. And for some of you that remember, the idea is to entice film production companies to come to the state of Wyoming. At the time that we made the decision on the amount that could be rebated, film productions were at a much higher cost, and what we based ours on were between $6 and $9 million. Since the time that we implemented this, we've had a lot of great interest. The rates have increased substantially for the production possibilities, but in the interim of that, we've had a writer's strike and we've had an economic downturn. So we've got a lot of productions that could be possible, but at a lower level. So what we'd like to do, since there's a sunset date of 2011, is to reduce that requirement to $200,000 for a project that up to that they could get a rebate on, if possible. So I'd ask for your favorable support.
Is there discussion on the bill?
Question?
Question hasn't been called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 71 do pass. Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The ayes have it. House Bill 71 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 18. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 18, introduced by Representative Dan Zwanitzer, an act relating to elections and voting rights. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. No, Gingrey, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
Chairman Gingrey, please proceed.
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 18 do pass. And I turn over the explanation to the gentleman from Laramie.
Laramie County, Representative Dan Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to present House Bill 18, Voting Rights. Currently, Wyoming requires a 5-year waiting period after you've served your probation parole sentence before you can apply to the Board of Parole to get your voting rights back. This bill does one simple three-word change, changes that from 5 years to 1 year. Currently, in this regard, Wyoming is the third most restrictive state in the country. Kentucky and Virginia never allow nonviolent or this is just for nonviolent felons, by the way. Currently, Kentucky and Virginia never allow you to have your voting rights back. Maine and Vermont allow you to vote from prison, actually. And every other state is kind of across the board, somewhere in between. So by passing this bill, there would still be 35 states that are more flexible than we are in this regard. But it was a good compromise. 1 year after you've been out of prison and served your sentence or your probation, you can reapply to the Board of Parole and you can vote in our state again. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chairman Landon, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if you had a list of what the nonviolent felonies are in the state. You know, I guess I would kind of hope that a felony would really be a serious. I know we've been adding more on, but it should really rise to a level of doing something that has some consequences. And I'm just worried a little bit about lowering this. But if I have a list or some examples of most of the things that are nonviolent felonies, maybe I'd change my mind.
Chairman Lebnow, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, technically I'm not a chairman. I'm just, I am a representative, not just a representative. To answer my good friend from House District 30, the nonviolent felonies are the offenses against property, property defacement and destruction, and burglary and criminal intrusion, larceny, fraud, check fraud, credit card fraud, identity theft. Let me turn to the next series of pages. Public indecency, prostitution, obscenity, desecrating graves, mutilating bodies, bribery, issue of false misconduct, mistreating person. I don't know if mistreating persons in mental institutions or mental hospitals qualifies or not. It's not in that section. Hindering government operations, interference with a police officer, running a roadblock.
Just read the
read the violent felonies. I'm sorry. Violent felony means murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, sexual assault in the first degree, second degree, robbery, aggravated assault, aircraft hijacking, arson in the first or second degree, and aggravated burglary.
Question? Question having been called. All those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so, that the recommendation that House Bill 18 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The noes have it. Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, the bill having failed a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will please read the roll.
Anderson. Bagby.
Aye.
Barbudo.
Aye.
Berger.
No.
Blake.
Aye.
Bonner.
No.
Brechtel. Brechtel. Brown.
No.
Buchanan.
No.
Byrd.
Kennedy.
Kennedy. Carson.
No.
Fielders.
No.
Cohey.
No.
Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Davison.
No.
Dirks.
No.
Edmonds.
No.
Esquibel.
Aye.
Gilmore.
No.
Gingery.
No.
Goggles.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye.
Hallinan.
Aye.
Hammonds.
No.
Harshman.
No.
Harvey. Illaway, Yagi, Jorgensen, Landon, Lockhart, Lubnow, Madden, McKim, McComey, Mercer, Meyer, Miller, Millen, Moniz, Patton, Peasley, Pedersen.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Philp.
No.
Horberg.
Aye.
Roscoe.
Aye.
Semlek.
No.
Shepperson.
Aye.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Teeters.
No.
Thompson.
Aye.
Throne.
Aye.
Wallace.
Aye.
Zwanitz or Dan.
Aye.
Zwanitz or Dave.
Aye.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
Brechtel.
Excused. I can't. I withdraw that. He better be here quick.
Patton. Patton, aye. Peasley. Brechtel. Peasley. I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Roscoe. Aye. Tano. Meyer. You're good. Miller. I'm thrown off here. Miller. No to aye. Gilmore. No to aye. Are there any other changes? Jorgensen. Aye to no. Jorgensen. Aye to no. Brechtel.
Aye.
Brechtel. Aye. Any other changes? Peasley. I'm about to close the vote. Are there further changes? The vote is closed. 26 ayes, 33 noes, 1 absent.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 18, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 261. Can the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 261, introduced by Representative Bagby, an act relating to Department of Corrections inmates regarding mandatory savings for inmates. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
Representative Bagby. Chairman Gingrey.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 261 do pass, and I turn over the explanation to the good gentleman from Rollins.
Now, Representative Bagby, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do my best with this bill about this time of night. I'm blind in one eye, and I can't see out of the other one. Members of the 60th, this bill... House Bill 261, Mandatory Savings Accounts for Inmates, was brought to me by the Department of Corrections. And I'll briefly give you an explanation of the bill. Inmates confined to the Wyoming Department of Correction receive payments for services which are performed by the prisoner under WS-716-202. The types of services for which inmates are paid include such things as cooking the food, doing the laundry, sweeping the floors, and working in prison industries, sewing garments, and building cabinets. Each WDOC institution is like a city, and inmates perform many of the tasks that a city would need to operate. They are janitors, garbage men, dishwashers, laundry operators, cooks, tutors, and library cooks. The amount of money that inmates earn for their services that they perform depends on the skill levels that they need to do these jobs. Inmate incentive wages range on an average of from $20 a month for entry-level labor-type positions up to $160 a month for skilled equipment operators, like a heavy equipment operator, for example. These wages provide inmates with a source of limited income and serve as an incentive for them to be productive while they are incarcerated. This proposed legislation would require a 10% portion of any payment for services received by the inmates under WS-716-202 to be deposited in the trust and agency account at the institution as a mandatory savings account for use by the prison and the prisoner upon relief. Currently, very few, if any, inmates save any portion of their earnings, as current statutes do not require any portion of those earnings to be saved for availability upon release. Therefore, prisoners most often seek to make their immediate circumstances more comfortable by sending their discretionary earnings on items available to them for purchase through the canteen system, such as additional food items and snacks. They do not readily think in the long term and thus seldom invest any of their earnings into safety and savings. Thus, prisoners often depart from incarceration with no financial resources available to assist them in the transition process other than a bus ticket to their ultimate destination and enough money for meals en route. This means that many of the inmates returning to our communities must rely on others, including homeless shelters or the state, to provide for them until they can find a job and earn enough money to begin to fend for themselves. A limited mandatory savings account would provide prisoners with some personal funding and could increase their likelihood of being able to secure housing and transportation upon relief. If the prisoner is paroled in state, he receives a bus ticket to anywhere within the state. If he is released and not on parole, he receives a bus ticket to any state he chooses. Now, just briefly, I'll go through the bill. If you'll go to page 1, line 15, payment for services performed by any prisoner under WS-716-202 shall be deposited in a trust agency account at the institution and shall be dispersed for the purposes provided in this subsection. Now, here's something that's kind of important in this bill. Unless the prisoner is serving a sentence of death or life without the possibility of parole or is subject to mandatory savings, 10% to the prisoner's personal savings account within the correctional facility's trust and agency account until the prisoner's account has a balance of $1,000. Once the prisoner's personal savings balance reaches $1,000, the income otherwise distributed to the prisoner's savings account under this paragraph will be distributed to the prisoner as provided by paragraphs through the subsection of this section. Funds in the prisoner's personal savings account shall be paid to the prisoner upon parole or final discharge. Personal necessities and assessments of fees for programs, services, and assistance pursuant to subsection E of this section. Now, a lot of times what they do with their money is they have to pay their money out. Court-ordered restitution, fines, sanctions, reimbursements for services of public defender or court-appointed counsel, the surcharges imposed upon the victim's compensation obligations, and some of these prisoners, by the time they get ready to leave prison and they're off of parole, are completely broke. And a lot of them also have to pay child support. So that's why they want to put this 10% into a prisoner's account. Mr. Chairman, at that, I'll stand for questions.
Chairman Lockhart, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this sounds like a good bill, and I support that, but I have one question. If the money goes into a savings account and the prisoner does not get parole or final discharge, what happens to the money that they've tried to save?
Well, it goes into kind of an account, a savings account, and it can actually go to whoever he wills it to. If he happens to die before he's paroled, was that your question? Okay, that's what happens. It just, you know, a lot of them, if they don't have any family, they'll leave it to somebody that they've met within the prison. But most of them have family, so they'll leave the money in that account to their families.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 261 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. House Bill 261 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 152. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 152, introduced by Representative Harshman, an act relating to professions and occupations, athletic trainers licensing. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubnow, McKim, McComey, Teeters. No, Brechtel. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass with amendments. I, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, sign Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 152 do pass, and there is a standing committee amendment, which the good lady of the Appropriations Committee will move and explain.
Chairman Berger, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 152, and I ask for your favorable aye. The act, what we do here is we're inserting this appropriation shall not be included in the 2011-12 standard biennial budget request of the State Board of Athletic Trainings. And basically our reason for that in appropriations is this is to be startup funds for this program. So I'd call for the question.
Question. Question having been called on House Bill 152, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. The bill has been amended. Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the 60th, House Bill 152 is a friend of this body. We've passed it, I think, twice. Well, last year it went out 60-love. And passed two Senate committees, ran out of time on the general file. Basically, athletic trainers are certified folks who have beyond master's degrees education. I have a one-pager that's just hit your tray. Appreciate the staff expediting that. And basically, these folks work in our schools, colleges, universities, our other health facilities, work in concert with physicians and physical therapists. Currently, athletic trainers operate under an exemption of the Physical Therapist Practice Act, the PT Practice Act. Of course, that is another bill that's coming our way, but athletic trainers would like their own licensure. It's a small board, one physician, two athletic trainers appointed by the governor. Most of it is just standard licensure bill write-up. If you look through page 2 and 3 are definitions. Starts on page 4 is pretty much standard licensure language through page 2, 4, 5, 6, 7. Really, it talks, these are all read pretty much the same. And then on page 9, it talks about really the effective date will be July 1st, 2010, so that no person will hold themselves out as an athletic trainer or work for pecuniary gain, be employed as an athletic trainer unless they are, number one, exempted under this act. So a person that has an exemption as a physical therapist or a coach or someone who has training in that area can still continue to practice athletic training, or they have to be licensed. And it goes through on page 10 some of the exemptions, folks who have certifications by other state agencies. If you flip over to page 11, persons serving from other states here temporarily, I think Cheyenne Frontier Days wouldn't affect that. And then as we go to page 12, 13, and with reciprocity, renewal of license, disciplinary action, these are pretty standard things that are in all of our licensing boards. The bottom line, these folks have doubled in the past 10 years, so they'll continue to grow and double. The University of Wyoming has a certification program, and then folks can move on to master's degrees and others through our recognized program at the University of Wyoming. So I would stand for any questions and ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Madden, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to the sponsor of this is that, you know, number one, why is this necessary? Number two, who's requesting this? You know, to me it's important whether or not consumers are requesting this, the people they're serving, or whether the trainers themselves are requesting it. Normally, if the suppliers or the trainers are requesting it, they have an insidious desire to restrict entry into the business, and thereby enable themselves to charge higher fees, and particularly when these kind of of licensing requirements come into place, it invariably affects small communities that might have small YMCAs and things like this. And I guess I'm just always a little bit skeptical of any licensing scheme, because it's always a turns in to be directly or indirectly a tactic to protect participants on the supply side. Thank you.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the questions. The words were used, insidious scheme and tactic, and to restrict business. I would tell you that it's not that insidious, and it's not a scheme, certainly. There's one certification organization in the United States, and that's the National Athletic Trainers Board. And these folks take a national certified exam. So it's not a situation where the state can restrict them. These folks, upon their passing the national test, can apply and gain entry and licensure. Now, who asked for this? Partly the physical therapists who the ATs work under the PT Act, under an exemption, and also the ATs themselves. It's not really a thing to restrict or charge higher fees. These folks work in a variety of situations. It's more of a professional recognition as the healthcare providers, and it doesn't really impact folks in our schools. It does not impact folks in our schools. I'm a certified teacher, so I'm exempt from this. It's just those folks who are holding themselves out to be licensed certified trainers. They have to work under the auspices and direction of a physician. That's in the bill. And what else can I tell you? I guess we're one of nine states that has not passed this similar legislation. So I answered your questions from the good representative from Buffalo. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hallman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have one more question for the good sponsor of the bill. How does this aid the public over and above the certification which is now available, so we can see who's certified to do this kind of work? How does licensure add to the safety of the public? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question from the good physician. I think the key is that folks can't hold themselves out to be trainers, athletic trainers. And right now, without a licensing board and without a description of that, folks can say, yeah, I'm an athletic trainer, and I can work for you as an athletic trainer. And really with no certification or licensure requirements, there's no definition of that currently. So this is for folks who are applying for these jobs, holding themselves out to be for folks working for pecuniary gain. We want them to be certified so they are who they say they are and who we think they are. So I hope I answered your question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have a question on the floor? Question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Representative McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that do so with a recommendation that House Bill 152 do pass, please signify by saying aye. All opposed, say no. The ayes have it. House Bill 152 passes the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 223. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 223, introduced by Representative Simpson, an act relating to education regarding bullying prevention. This bill went before the Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Connolly, Kraft, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, no, Brechtel, Dirks, Teeters.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey, please start us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 223 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I will turn this over, the explanation of the amendment and the bill, to the sponsor, our Speaker.
Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 223 is an improved version of House Bill 122 that was sponsored by representatives in this House. And that was That bill had been filed, and I was working on another bill, and I saw their bill and suggested that I had some changes, and it was suggested to me that I just run my bill. So here's House Bill 223. They both achieve pretty much the same end. Mine encompasses electronic communications, and I'll tell you about that. This act would be known as the Safe School Climate Act. And on page 1, then it goes over to page 2. There are definitions on page 2, line 8, of harassment, intimidation, or bullying. Means any intentional gesture or any intentional electronic communication or any intentional written, verbal, or physical act that a reasonable person in the circumstances should know will have the effect of harming a student physically or emotionally, damaging a student's property, or placing a student in reasonable fear of personal harm or property damage, or insulting or demeaning a student or group of students causing substantial disruption. That's a key word there, substantial disruption in or substantial interference with the orderly operation of the school. Then under subparagraph C, if it's sufficiently severe, persistent, or pervasive that it creates an intimidating, threatening, or abusive educational environment. And then school is defined, and it's a pretty broad definition. It includes the school bus stop, the school bus, an activity or event sponsored by a school, and any other program or function where the school is responsible for the child. Paragraph or page 3, line 14, is the prohibition that this bill creates against harassment, intimidation, or bullying. The Standing Committee amendment begins to affect this bill at page 3, line 21 and 22. No person shall engage in harassment, intimidation, or bullying, or reprisals, retaliation, or false accusation against a victim, witness, or person. And then we insert, who in good faith reports, and then strike with reliable. So it reads, who in good faith reports information. So no person can retaliate or take some acts of reprisal against a person who reports in good faith. And then page 4 requires the school district to adopt policies prohibiting harassment, intimidation, or bullying. And then it goes through what the policy needs to include. And the definition it has to meet the minimum as defined in the bill. And it has to address consequences for such actions, procedures for reporting, procedures for investigation, and a statement that, again, that prohibition against reprisal or retaliation. And then the Department of Education would adopt rules under subparagraph C on page 6 over to page 7. Each district, this is subparagraph D, would include the policy in their publication of comprehensive rules, and then information would be provided to volunteers or other non-certified employees under subparagraph E. Then section 315 at the bottom of page 7 over to 8 clarifies that this article shall not be interpreted to prevent a victim from seeking redress pursuant to any other applicable civil or criminal law. And the Standing Committee Amendment also addresses page 8 of the bill in this section. And I'll just read it as the Standing Committee Amendment has it read. This article does not create or alter any civil cause of action for monetary damages against any person or school district, nor shall it constitute grounds for any claim or motion raised by either the state or defendant in any proceedings, except that the defense of immunity shall be retained and may be asserted in any action arising under this act. This bill does not have any forced obligation to report anything. I took that out of the draft. I don't like those provisions. They just create lots of problems. And so when you take that mandatory reporting out, you don't have to have immunity grants for that reporting. So on page 1 of the bill, lines 5 and 6, where it says providing immunity for school employees and volunteers as specified, that's gone. There is no immunity. But the immunity provision is just clarified to indicate that any immunity that applies to a person or a school district still applies. And this act, I actually met the woman who helped write this act, this federal act, actually, And many school districts around the country and many states have adopted these requirements to adopt the Safe School Climate Act. There is a lot of bullying that goes around electronically, either through emails or texting, and aside from simply the physical and verbal bullying that's been existing for years. And really, this just requires the districts to adopt the policies and have some rules in place to address these issues that impact our youth. And I'd stand for any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, and if none, I'd call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question? Question being called on House Bill 223, Standing Committee Number 1. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The Standing Committee Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Discussion? Representative Dirks.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps a view from the front lines. Certainly bullying would have to rank up there, probably above cognitive growth in what we deal with every day. Bullying is not something new, despite some of the testimony we heard in committee that seemed to indicate that maybe schools were oblivious to bullying. We are not. We see it from the first time the student steps on the bus, the last time they leave the door. On the Friday before we came into session, you'll recall, a full moon was imminent. Like many of you, I was thinking of the session, trying to make the transition. I was probably 10 steps out the door when I got a phone call, was called back into the office. Very angry parent on the other line. His son had come home and told him that he had been abused under my jurisdiction. I, in the process of defending myself, I sent father into an even higher orbit of concern, and he called the police and he was coming to get me. And so the school personnel sequestered me away and met the parent at the door, and in the 10 degree below weather, have a nice long conversation with the parent. And afterward, the policeman came in and were just staring at me, and I was all ready to be interrogated. But what they were staring at me for was they wondered if I was all right. Suddenly they were worried about me after having such a long conversation with the angry father. And we heard some testimony in committee from a parent who also most genuinely felt that schools were just not doing something about that. And even though I've been down here and have not had a chance to talk to the parent about the incident, if I would have, I would have told him that I was not oblivious to it. I saw it. And I saw his son stand up for himself. And until I heard that the father was so angry, I was happy about the incident because here's a little seventh grade boy who had been taking it for about a year and a half, and finally he wasn't. And then I would have said to the father, I know right where you're coming from, because as my son went through our school, he experienced these things that many of your children have, being pushed into lockers, shoved into toilets. And it wasn't like I was turning my face. It wasn't like I was looking the other way. I wouldn't have known about these incidents at all had our daughter not told us. And I'm guessing that many of you have experienced the same thing. It's not that school personnel are oblivious to these instances. Well, it's true. We can make policies right now, and we do make policies, and our school has a no-tolerance policy for bullying. Zero tolerance. And at the start of the school year, our principal gathered all the students together and pronounced that we, in our system, would have a zero-tolerance policy toward bullying. And as you might guess, probably 35 feet out the door, someone was tripped, someone was slammed into a locker somewhere. We can't be omnipresent. And so, as some of us vote with caution on matters like this, it's because sometimes the formulation of a statement like this, as it did in our school, presents a false sense of security. We're going to pass a bill called the Safe Schools Climate Act, and some students out there might suddenly feel like things are a whole lot safer. And so I certainly applaud all efforts to end bullying, and I think those of us on the front line are trying all the time. And I fear that while we in the system are busy formulating new policies, Mr. Bully's going to be out there having his way.
Thank you. Representative Wallace, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we need to vote for this. I come from a small rural community. When our kids hit eighth grade, get out of eighth grade, they go to town. I can tell you that that environment is brutal. I can tell you that my son's best friend, a young man, a ballet dancer, went to town and because he was brutally bullied as being gay, his mom was a teacher at the school. He and my son had plans to go to a film, go to a show that Friday night. He came home and blew his brains out when he was 15 years old. That is unacceptable. Unacceptable. And we need to send a clear message to these schools and to those parents and to those kids that our society will not tolerate that. Thank you.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the good speaker. Well, and I think maybe I got some of it, but if he might know more. Is this something that districts can do on their own, and have they done it? And I think we already heard one incident, but I'm just wondering if we could elaborate on, have districts chosen to do this, or they have chosen not to, or have they done it to this extent or to lesser extent? And then on page 2, line 15, just the harming a student physically or emotionally, and it's the word emotionally that I'm just can't get my hands around. I mean, I'm not quite for sure how the school's going to be able to set a policy to really touch on emotional harassment. So if the speaker has just something more that he can maybe help me with on that one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Gingrey, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the bringer of the bill. On page 3, lines 14 through 24, it says, no person shall engage in, and then it has two different subsections. Is that a criminal act or just a suggestion that you shouldn't do this? But I don't see any penalty for it, so I'm assuming that it's not a criminal act. It's just a suggestion, and if you do it, you know, there's no punishment for doing it. And then my other question is, in the laws, do we have other sections where we tell local school districts what their policies will be, or more appropriately, I guess the question is, don't most school districts in the state already have a policy? I'm not sure if we need to be telling the school district to adopt a policy when my assumption was that they all had one, but maybe they don't. Maybe this is needed to tell them how to do their job. But more importantly, I was just asking, is that a criminal act?
Representative Harshman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to comment on the school district implementation. I really don't think this is an onerous thing to our school district. Most of the districts have policies. This will only, I think, act to strengthen those, provide at least a floor level for districts to get in. But, you know, schools have worked very hard at this because it is a problem, and it's actually gotten more insidious and kind of nastier, and particularly with the electronic bullying. It's just, and we've all read the horror stories and
MySpace and suicides and all those things. And we've done a pretty good job with sexual harassment, I think, in the schools. And for a long time, that was kind of the norm. And we've really gotten kids educated what's appropriate and what's not. And it's an ongoing thing. But once you kind of cross one barrier and you think you're making ground on it, then something that's invented like text messaging or MySpace or Facebook. And so it's a constant thing. And I think this is a good bill to send a message that, you know, and the Supreme Court said that we as legislators are tasked to look at the school system and regulate and come up with policies. That's our job. It's not the state superintendent of instruction's job. It's solely our job. And I think this sends a strong message. And I would say a lot of good work's being done, but this will only strengthen it. And so I'd encourage your support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to answer some of the questions. I'm sure some I know some districts have harassment policies. I don't know whether they follow this definition of the Safe School Climate Act, harassment, intimidation, or bullying. I doubt they do. But some of them may have gone out and know that there's a federal act and adopted that themselves. The emotional harm, I didn't quite understand the question. Was it that you don't understand how a student is harmed emotionally, or how you show emotional harm? Maybe you could clarify that for me.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would the district quantify emotional harm, and how are they going to be able to prove that they're emotionally? Yeah, I'm just worried about reprisals sometimes, that someone could just say they were emotionally harmed, not anything else. And how would the district go about that?
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's pretty easy to tell when the student doesn't want to go to school, and they're a senior in high school and they still don't want to go to school. Some of the testimony in the committee was from a woman whose senior son was still being bullied. And I've heard too many stories about bullying to believe that it isn't serious. And but to get to the point, subparagraphs A1, B, and C have some qualifiers, like on line 20, the word substantial disruption. Page 2, line 23, sufficiently severe. Maybe subparagraph A. The one in subparagraph A is the reasonable fear on line 16. I think those are some of the things that the administration would look at to determine whether there was harassment. If the person said, well, you know, that email really hurt my feelings, did that put them in a reasonable fear of their personal harm or property damage? Probably not. So that's up to the discretion. It is not a criminal act. It's a suggestion. There is no penalty, but the district can adopt any policies they want that would reflect a violation of the definition. And sure, we tell districts what policies shall be. We tell them all kinds of things. And so I can't give you a specific item right now, and I'll try and find that out. You know, the thing about electronic bullying is it can be anonymous, and it can be really pervasive, and it's pretty easy to see someone being physically bullied or even emotionally bullied verbally in front of you, and that happens all the time. But with the kids who have their phones all the time and they're receiving harassing or really damaging text messages, I can't imagine really what it would be like to be in high school right now with all of the electronic communication that goes on. I can certainly recall times when I saw things that just made me cringe about what kids did to each other, and I'm sure I deeply offended some other students too. But the electronic stuff and the Facebook and
MySpace. If you've never been on those sites, and as a lawyer, I've had occasions to investigate some of those sites in domestic relations cases, and I am just blown away by the stuff on there and that's the stuff that the kids themselves post, and then other kids can post to it too. I mean, it's probably all of us know somebody in our family who's been bullied enough. Heck, I remember being chased to school every day in the third grade by these guys who would get me down and rough me up every day. They thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was fun for a day, but after that. But if it's electronic and you don't share it, who knows that it's happening other than you? And if you want to report it anonymously, you ought to be able to do that, and somebody ought to be able to investigate it for you and see if it rises to the level of the things in this act. Does it give a false sense of security? I don't think so. I never thought of the bill in that way. I think it would give a great sense of insecurity to people who are out there bullying other students, that they would know that there's now a policy that's mandated in their district not to do it. And I think that's what we need. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Landon, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm on and for the bill because we have no alternative. We made a policy decision earlier that we were just going to have government schools, which require attendance. And so students don't have a choice. They don't have the opportunity to attend a school in which it's a privilege to behave in a certain manner and oblige themselves of the culture of that school. And so without those type of controls, I think that this you have to go this route.
Representative Harvey, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question would be, I guess I'm trying to process all of this and how it's going to work. And I see kids that are not allowed to have their electronic devices with them in class. In fact, one of the schools that's in my district confiscates them, and they can't have them back until their parents come with them to get it back. And so I think that this cyberbullying that we're talking about continues to happen even after school hours. And so I question the school's ability to regulate this at all, particularly if they have if they have policies in place that the electronic devices are not even allowed. Now, I know that they can get on the school computers and send messages that way, but it seems to me that there's some of this that's just simply out of the school's control, and I wonder if the phone itself is not allowed in the school at the time, then I would think that the student would be in violation of another policy. And then you've got the time stamps that come with messages that are sent back and forth, and I guess you could prove whether they happen during school hours or not. But it seems to me that the majority of the cyberbullying that we're talking about happens outside of the school and outside of school hours.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question? Question haven't been called. All those in favor of Representative McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 223 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The ayes have it. House Bill 223 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 271. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 271, introduced by Representative Berger, an act relating to Medicaid, speech, and audiology services. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Landon, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 271 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I would like to turn the podium over to the good representative who lives up the creek from myself.
Isn't that creek? Chairman Berger, please proceed.
It's the Little Goose Creek, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you Medicaid Speech and Audiology Services. And basically what this bill does is it adds certified licensed speech pathologists and licensed audiologists to the Medicaid appropriation. What it really does is it just expands for new providers a surface to patients. It doesn't increase the patient load. What I discovered with working with a local speech pathologist in my community is that they often get referrals from their physician, but it doesn't get covered if they are a private contractor. The only way that they can provide this service currently is at our local hospital, and that is all that this bill does. It was in 2003 that we added physical occupational therapists to this service, and so it's just kind of adding that and cleaning up that piece of legislation. Thank you. I ask for your favorable eye.
Is there any further discussion on the bill?
Question?
Question having been called. All those in favor of Representative Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 271 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes have it. House Bill 271 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
That was pretty close. The ayes have it.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 114, amended. And further amended. Recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again. The motion prevailed. House Bill 222, amended. Recommended do pass. House Bill 229, amended. And further amended. Recommended do pass. House Bill 242, recommended do pass. House Bill 100, Representative Stubson announced a conflict of interest on House Bill 100, recommended do pass. House Bill 234, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 96, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 274, amended and further amended, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 71, recommended do pass. House Bill 18, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 261, recommended do pass. House Bill 152, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 223, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 271, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Carson, Chairman.
Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Thank you, Representative Carson. Good job.
Chairman Illaway, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to remind you one more time, those blue books will be on sale tomorrow morning from 8 to 10 in the rotunda. I was just asked a question. You'll be able to buy all five books. If you bought those, if you've bought blue books prior to today or tomorrow, you bought volumes 1 through 4 because we did sell them last year. You do not have volume 5. That's the new one. But as I say, they will be available tomorrow, and they'll take your check or whatever. So think about that tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon.
Messages from the Senate.
Message 190, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 32, Wyoming Livestock Health and Emergency Disease Program. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 191, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Excuse me. Gillette Madison Pipeline Project, ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 192, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 132, Board of Embalming Membership, ayes 30, noes 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 193, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 136, Homicide Aggravating Circumstances, ayes 22, noes 8, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 194, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 137, Health Care Rehabilitation Facility, ayes 30, noes 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 195, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 106, Medication Disposal Program, ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 196, Mr. Speaker, the Senate adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bills listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 131, Management Audit Study Reading Skills, ayes 11, noes 19, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 184, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace, signed Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 283, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace, excused, Goggles, signed Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 307, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Wallace, no, Edmonds, Escobel, Peterson, Semlek, signed Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 226, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 32, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Shepperson, Thompson. No, Davison, Yagi, Millen, signed Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 286, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson, signed Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 85, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave. No, Gilmore, signed Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 179, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Hallinan, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave. No, Madden, signed Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Highways, Military, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 191, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Peterson, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Business and Minerals Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 262, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Stubson. No, Byrd, Roscoe, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 288, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 301, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. Committee announcements, Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow at noon upon noon recess in House 18. We'll finish discussing House Bill 294, Prescription Drug Database. Then we'll discuss House Bill 295, Western States Energy and Environment Symposium. And we'll discuss House Bill 314, Decommissioning of Wind Turbines. And if we have time, House Bill 305, Reduced Cigarette Ignition.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet this afternoon upon adjournment at 5 o'clock in Room 302 to hear House Bill 151, Ultrasound Required for Abortions, and House Bill 154, Abortion Reporting Requirements. The committee will meet once again tomorrow morning at 8:30 in our regular committee room to hear House Bill 298, Medical Practice Act Revisions.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet in 5 minutes at 5 o'clock in B63 in the Herschler Building to continue taking testimony on House Bill 273, Duty Owed to Employees of Independent Contractors, and to take up House Bill 64, Co-Employee Immunity. Tomorrow morning, starting at 8 a.m. in our regular room, H8, we will take up House Bill 278, Sex Offenders Internet Access, House Bill 297, Simple Assault, House Bill 284, Impoundment of DUI Vehicles.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow night, Thursday, February 5th, upon adjournment in room H17, to discuss House Bill 197, Breast Cancer License Plate, House Bill 211, Veterans License Plate, House Bill 125, Establishment of Highways, House Bill 267, Commercial Motor Vehicles Definitions, House Bill 276, Transportation Funding Cost Increases, if time permits, House Bill 310, Safety Belt Violations, if time permits, and House Bill 256, Use of Cell Phones While Driving, if time permits.
That was the use of cell phones while driving, if time permits? No, Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, your committee number four, Education, will meet tonight, hopefully by 5 o'clock, in room H10, where we can take up House Bills 236, School Finance Instructional Facilitator Program, House Bill 248, School Facilities Remedy Criteria, House Bill 249, Public Education Accountability, and House Bill 255, School Districts Kindergarten Programs.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number five, Agricultural, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning, Thursday, February 5, 7 a.m., to hear House Joint 16, Immigration Reform, House Bill 208, Brands, House Joint 14, National Animal Identification System, Senate File 8, Engrossed Feral Livestock, and Senate File 36, Intentional Feeding of Elk. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Chairman Berger.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. It's nice to be back in my neighborhood. I've been missing it. Tomorrow, your Appropriations Committee number two will meet at 8 o'clock for House Bill 238, Tax Refund to the Elderly and Disabled, House Bill 253, Healthcare Commission, and House Bill 266, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes Initiatives. And then upon noon recess, we'll continue the discussion on House Bill 299, School Facilities Budget Process. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor. A reminder for those of the legislative prayer breakfast tomorrow morning, 6:30 at the Egg and I. All are welcome.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader. Minority Whip.
Privilege of the floor, Mr. Speaker.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Please. Speaker. Just very quickly, members, there is a reception this evening at 6:30 at the Hitching Post, and no, it's not closed, it's still open, by the Arapaho Business Council and the Wind River Casino. Hope to see you there.
The chairman of the Banjo Committee, Representative Thompson, is going to lead us in Cowboy Joe, but let's adjourn first. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m., February 5th, 2009.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.